Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
I'm here with Rosa Hoskins on the occasion of the publication of her book, It's All Going Wonderfully Well, Growing Up with Bob Hoskins. Mm-hmm. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous.
Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Okay. It's pretty much 2 years to the day of your father's death, which, as we'll get into, hit you like a freight train.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling 2 years on?
I think it's interesting with death because it's not something that you get over. It's not something, you know, people talk about getting over and moving on, and that applies to the breakup of a relationship or if your house burns down or you lose a job, or there are lots of, you know, terrible things that can happen to you that you move on from. But you don't move on, and I haven't moved on from Dad and I never will, but you recover and you start to... You incorporate the loss and the grief into your life. And I think that's definitely the sort of the road that I'm on. I haven't got there yet. I'm not fully recovered. But I think in a way writing the book kind of speeded up the grieving process in a way, because I was forced to face things and engage with things that I might not have really wanted to. So, for example, you know, I watched loads of his films, which was incredibly difficult and somewhat sadistic, I think, really. But having done that, it's like I've faced it. I've looked it in the eye and I've faced it down. And I think that might have taken me a few more years before I would have been able to do that. So the book was incredibly hard to write at times, but there's been some definite therapeutic benefits.
Tell me about the story attached to the title.
So my dad, many years ago, in the days of rep theatre, he was auditioning for a rep company, and he went into the auditorium where he went into the theatre where all the other actors are waiting, you know, for their turn. And suddenly there's this ruckus backstage, and the leading lady of the company comes running out in floods of tears, followed by the leading man, who's hot on her trails. He grabs one of her shoulders, turns her round and punches her square in the face, knocks her out, right? She crumples, passed out. He turns round and realises that a theatre full of people have just seen him punch a woman in the face. So he scarpers pretty quickly. And then a rather sort of plump, dumpy stage manageress comes bouncing on, sees an unconscious woman with a bloody nose on the stage and realises what's happened, turns around to the assembled actors and goes, "It's all going wonderfully well." And then bounces off again. And since then, whenever things aren't going wonderfully well, that's when Dad would pipe up with, "It's all going wonderfully well."
It's fantastic.
Radio Gorgeous, the sexist station where you'll only hear the female voice.
So I think it was quite perceptive on your part to notice that your father's quickness to temper was probably a reaction to him being given the mantle of the man of the family quite early in his life.
Yeah.
Why was he given that mantle?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, my granddad was a sweet, kind, lovely man. And I don't really understand his decision around that, but he did quite literally say to Dad, "You're the man of the house now," when Dad was about 12 or 13. I don't know why, I don't understand, I don't know enough about my granddad's background to explain it, really. But that's what happened. And yeah, I think Dad did feel... It's that thing that children do, you know, you just, you do what your parents expect you to do. And whether it's kind of actively or, you know, subconsciously, you just do it.
And you suppress a part of yourself in doing that.
Yeah, yeah,
and then
yeah.
It comes out.
And then it comes out to bite you in the...
Or anyone else around you.
Yeah, quite. I've got to say, though, I mean, Dad did have a temper, for sure, but it was rare. You know, he didn't flip his lid on a daily basis. It was, you know, it wasn't like this happened every week or even every month. But, you know, when he lost his temper, you'd know about it. But it was very brief and it was gone and the argument was over. Not even an argument, you know, the thing that he was mad about was done. And actually, I this is very un-English. Americans are much, much better at this stuff. But I find it quite difficult now being around people who don't really say what they mean, or people who are mad at you, but they won't say why. And, you know, it's just like, oh, God.
Which is sort of holding you hostage.
Oh, it's awful.
And not allowing you to address it.
I know. It's the worst thing. Like, passive aggression is my absolute bugaboo. It's so frustrating.
Maddening.
And 9 times out of 10, it is something that's kind of easily resolved. It doesn't have to go on
and escalate and make me act like an asshole.
Exactly.
You're driving me crazy now, telling me what the hell I did.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I find that really tough now. I find, like, when people are like that, it's like, oh my God. And the problem is, like you say, it engenders, like, negative behavior from you. So then I become aggressive. Like, passive aggression kind of provokes actual aggression from me. I'm like, what is bothering you? Just tell me. And then that person gets, like, scared, and then it's all a kind of a negative cycle. But I find like, the close relationships that I build now at this point in my life are with people who say what they mean and don't hold grudges. And if they're mad, they say they're mad, and then it's done. And I suppose maybe because Dad's gone and he was so like that, I suppose in a way I'm kind of looking to find as much of him in other people as I can. What I realise as well is that actually a lot of people do find that hard.
They find that hard. And then also, because I'm thinking of my husband, then also because, you know, like you, I get, you know, very bothered by that. It's that it's also trying to manage your reaction.
Yes.
And they should know by now, it's not manageable.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Fine,
yeah.
It's not manageable, it's going to happen, but, you know, then it's going to be over.
Then it's
and
done.
And then we can move on.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Get through it.
Yeah, exactly.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Do you think that... you're also, during your father's illness, one, holding it together during his illness and holding it sort of privately for him and your family,
I think,
gave you sort of the reaction you had afterwards.
What, in terms of?
Of having panic attacks. And
oh, do you know what? No, I think when Dad was ill, we all made a really, really concise effort to enjoy as much as we could, to kind of squeeze as much joy and loveliness out of every moment that we had, because we knew that it was limited. So the thing is, with an illness like that, is that it shrinks your world. So first he stopped work, and then he, you know, became, going out became difficult, and then walking, became, you know, it kind of gets shrinks. So, but at every point, I think we were all quite pragmatic and like, okay, well, this is the situation now. What can we do now that's going to be nice? It was lovely because I lived, you know, just up the street from them, and Dad would come and hang out with me, and, you know, he'd sit around in my kitchen living room, and I'd be trying to write something or learn some lines or whatever, and he'd just be watching telly, and, you know, we had this kind of, and I would look after him, but not in a, you know, it's funny with a parent, you know, that needs looking after. You kind of, you, I never wanted to kind of undermine him, but I still kind of really kept an eye on him as well.
There was a funny story you told about that.
Oh yeah,
in the book where, you know, he goes to the bathroom and you sort of don't want to hover.
Well, he'd gone in. He'd gone into the loo, which is just next to my sort of kitchen area, and he'd been in there for ages, and I was like, "Dad, you all right?" And I hear this voice say, "Yes," and I'm like, "Do you need any help?" And he's like, "Don't think so." And I'm like, "Okay, shall I come in?" He's like, "If you like." And I was thinking, "Oh God, I really do. If he's stuck on the loo, I don't know. But I can't leave him there." Exactly. Do you know what I mean? This is going to be mortifying for both of us, but I can't leave him just stranded in there. So I open up the door to the toilet and he's not there. And I was like, "Dad?" And he's like, "Yes." And he'd gone and sat in the lounge in the front of my house. And because he was an actor, his voice carried down the hall. So it totally sounded like he was in the loo. And I came running down there and he's sitting there quite happily, you know. And I'm like, "Dad, I thought you were stuck in the loo." And he was like, "Soppy cow," you know, that's what he said.
Exactly. That's your problem.
Yeah.
That doesn't have anything to do with me.
Daft move. Yeah. And then I, you know, he was like, "Makes a cup of tea." And I was like, "All right, fine."
Radio Gorgeous, online, on your phone, on a podcast, or on your tablet. Listen anywhere, anytime.
One thing you did find helpful, which I do want to talk about, because it's something I discovered in the States, which is EMDR, because it can work a long time after trauma too.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's something that people should know as an alternative.
It's remarkable.
Just for the listeners, could you tell us what EMDR stands for?
So EMDR stands for Eye Movement Desensitization Reprocessing Therapy. But basically EMDR is where you talk about the traumatic event, and your therapist gets you to really engage with that moment, really go to that very traumatizing place that's very difficult to think about, and they wave a pencil or a pen in front of you, and you follow the pen or pencil with your eyes whilst thinking about the traumatizing event, and somehow it shifts it and it reprograms your brain to not be traumatized. And the problem with trauma is that when your brain revisits that traumatizing event, you're dragged kicking and screaming back into the emotional place that you were in. So I've written about my friend's wedding, and you know, everyone there is happy-go-lucky and oh, it's wonderful, and da da da. They're all there in the moment, where I'm actually in the hospital room where my dad died, you know, mentally. And it was such a strange experience. It was like having a out of body episode where I could see this lovely event going on that I desperately wanted to be a part of, but I was
you're on a different track.
Yeah. I was 6 months in the past, and you know, the EMDR was massively helpful because it allows your brain to go there, feel it, focus on it, kind of let it play itself out in a safe environment, and then you can let it go.
Exactly, without the sort of repercussions.
Exactly.
Of reliving it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's the reliving it that is difficult, because you know, you're pottering along doing whatever you're doing that day, and then suddenly, boom, you're back in that terrible place, and you feel the same things that you felt in that moment. In terms of the grieving process, I don't know what other people's experiences are. I suspect they're similar. But I found that the 6 month mark was way harder than the 6 hours, 6 days, 6 weeks. 6 months was like, oh my God, this person. Because before that, you're still in shock and you're still reeling, you know. But about 6 months or so, you've had the time to kind of allow the loss to kind of percolate, and you realize you have this sort of cold hard reality of like, my God, that person's not coming back. I'm never going to see him again. He's gone. And that is so bleak and stark and just, you know, terrifyingly real. But then, you know, it does lift. It does move. You know, you don't move on, you move forward. It changes. I'm very glad that I'm very, very glad that I had EMDR, because I think it allowed me to kind of it. I found the trauma sort of it gets in the way of the grieving process, because you're dealing with this debilitating symptom. And once I'd moved past that, I could then go, okay, right, so the next stage of the process is this, the next stage, you know. And then it obscures the grief, you know. But yeah, I mean, EMDR was so helpful.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
So what were, aside from obviously him dying at a relatively early age, what were the downsides of being Bob Hoskins' daughter?
What were the downsides? I suppose when I went to auditions, because I'm 5'9", like I have a neck. I'm not. Yeah, I don't talk in the way that Dad did. I think people kind of expected some sort of a short, stocky girl to show up, and then I would rock up, and they're like, "Oh, well, come back another time. We don't really know what to do with you." So there was that. But I mean, there weren't really that many downsides. I mean, he was away a lot when I was a kid. That was hard. But generally speaking, I mean, there weren't that many. You know, there were, you know, my life with him was not perfect. Of course it wasn't. No one's is. But I suppose one of the things that I really wanted from the book, and it's not even that I wanted it, I just realised that that was how it had to be, was to kind of to be honest and balanced about things. Because I could have very easily sugar-coated my memories of Dad and made him out to be some sort of saint, which he wasn't. And P.S. nobody is. You know, that's just not how human beings are. There's a quote from Hamlet. What is it? He was a man, take him all in all, I'll never see his like again. Something like that. I'm paraphrasing. I probably got that wrong. But it's, I wanted to write about him in a very real and honest way. And a journalist the other day said, "Oh, you've been quite critical of your dad." And I said, "Well, no, I haven't been critical of him. I've been honest." And he wasn't perfect, but I find that remembering him as he was keeps him closer to me. And I think as well, I think partly that's why people have responded to it, because it's real, it's genuine, and you know, and I was incredibly lucky, and I would rather have had him and lost him early than had some, you know. But some people, I mean, God, I know people whose parents are just dreadful. They're awful people, and they live for 100 years, just spreading their bilious horribleness everywhere, you know. And you know, so I do, even though I wish he hadn't got ill and I wish he hadn't died, but I still count myself lucky, because he was great. I mean, and he was so interesting as well. It's one of the things that I knew that already, but I've kind of reacquainted myself with that, you know, he was massively interesting. He was with mercurial.
Prodigious energy.
Yeah. And he was unpredictable. You know, he was, the things that he was interested in, like ancient Greek philosophy or the history of mathematics in the Middle East and all this quite, you know, dry, like esoteric stuff. People always thought, well, is he not into football? And, you know, it's like, no, he wants to watch like Time Team, you know. And he was such a one-off. He was so interesting, and he was interesting and interested, and he had this massive hunger for knowledge. And you know, he left school at, I think he was 14, and but he took it upon himself to read Dickens. You know, he just read all of Dickens, and he took it upon himself to read Shakespeare, and he took it upon himself to learn about things and to find out about things, and he just had this hunger to know. And I've written about how sometimes that could be quite difficult, because he would kind of isolate himself in his little bubble of whatever he was interested in. And, you know, there were times, particularly when he came home and he would be unavailable.
Yeah.
I would be like, you've been away for like 3 months, Dad. Can I not have a conversation with you? But what I realise in retrospect and with kind of an adult's sensibility is that, you know, because he was so able to engross himself in a part, when he came home, he needed that decompression time, and he needed to, it's what he used to call it, flushing, which is a slightly unfortunate choice of words, but fair enough, Dad. You know, that's what you call it.
Detox.
Yeah. It was a flush for him. Yeah, that's just what he needed to do. And it was hard as a kid, but I think that's one of the beauties of being an adult, is you go, yeah, well, you know, that was tough on me then, but I understand, and I see, you know, I can put myself in your shoes and see why that was necessary. There's loads of things about Dad that were really interesting and remarkable, but one of the things that really stands out for me now is how he was as an actor and how he was kind of in the business. And I think he had the kind of the lovely combination of being really good at his job, knowing that he was good at his job, but not being egotistical and not being vain and not thinking that because I'm an actor, I'm special. Mm-hmm. He wasn't like that. And there's one story that I think really sums up his lack of vanity and his his sense of he had a really good sense of humor about himself. You know, he's never take yourself too seriously, he used to say, because people who take themselves seriously are boring, and he was right. So there was one trip, I forget what project he was promoting, and he was going to Moscow. And he, you know, got off the plane at Moscow, and there's this crowd of people, you know, there's fans with placards and things. He said, oh, that's quite nice. And as he gets closer, he realises that this group of fans with placards are saying, welcome to Russia, Danny DeVito. So, and Dad being Dad, you know, another person might be furious and offended. Dad was kind of squared his shoulder, was like, all right.
And he, I'll take it.
Yeah, fine, fair enough. And he went around signing autographs for Danny DeVito for 2 weeks. And he was just like, he found it funny. He thought it was ridiculous. He found it funny, you know.
There's one short, dark-haired
actor. Yeah, that's it. And the next time he saw Danny DeVito, he was like, you owe me, son. You owe me.
2 weeks.
Yeah. You've got all kinds of fans in Russia, dude, because of me. So, yeah, no.
You have a really good reputation.
Yeah. I've done your rep a world of good. Yeah. No, so, and it's just things like that he was just so funny. He was so funny, and so he just didn't... I think as the grieving process carries on, as it continues, the sadness is always there and the loss is always there, but it eventually doesn't obscure the good stuff as much, and you're able to look back and laugh, and you're able to go, God, he was so funny, and... you know, the things he did and his attitude to things. And that's lovely. And that's really, and that's one of the things that I say to people now who've recently lost someone. I'm like, do you know what? This is really hard. And I'm not going to tell you it's not going to be hard, because it is hard. But there will be a time when you'll recover and you will be able to look back on this thing and go, oh God, that was wonderful. You know.
I was lucky.
Yeah, I was really lucky.
Thank you, Rosa.
You're very welcome.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us, contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com, and to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
You had plenty money, 1922. Some other men do. Get out of here. Give me some money too. The city. Get out of here. Get me some money too. Get out of here. Get me some money too. Why don't you do
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.